The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
You set her up. She was an innocent woman and you let Sloane destroy her. Why? She believed in the Alliance. She was on our side.
No, she wasn't. I told you before, Julian, she's a patriot. Which means if it serves the interest of the Romulans to negotiate a separate peace with the Dominion, Kreatak would push that option. And believe me, the Dominion would like nothing more than to make a deal with the Romulans right now.
So Koval becomes your guarantee that that does not happen. And as a man who was nearly killed for his anti-Federation activities, his recommendation to stay in the war becomes all the more convincing.
That's the general idea.
And how long have you worked for Section 31?
I don't.
Oh, just a temporary alliance, is it?
Something like that.
You don't see anything wrong with what happened, do you?
I don't like it. But I've spent the last year and a half of my life ordering young men and young women to die. I like that even less.
That's a glib answer. And a cheap way to avoid the fact that you've trampled on the very thing that those young men and women are out there dying to protect. Does that not mean anything to you?
Enter arma. Aenum silent legis.
In time of war, the law falls silent. Cicero. So is that what we have become? A 24th century Rome, driven by nothing other than the certainty that Caesar can do no wrong!
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, February the 14th, 2024. I'm Bob Metz.
And I'm Robert Vaughn.
And this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's just right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
So, genocide. What is it? And is the state of Israel guilty of genocidal action? And when it comes to the political definition game, it's important to know what the rules of that game are before drawing conclusions or falling prey to unrealistic expectations. Why this is so is something that our guest, Salim Mansour, makes startlingly clear right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org, hear us on WBCQ Shortwave, follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform, and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible.
On January 26th, the International Court of Justice gave its provisional decision on South Africa's allegation that Israel was violating the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. While it engages with a war with the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, in the Gaza Strip, it found that it was plausible that Israel was violating the convention and ordered Israel to abide by the terms of the convention. And with us to discuss the ramifications and fallout for this decision is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Western University, Salim Mansour. Salim, what is your take on the ICJ's decision?
On December 29, 2023, South Africa filed the application that Israel could be charged with violation of the Genocide Convention. And the hearings were heard of that application by the International Court of Justice on January 11th and 12th, with the oral presentations made by South Africa on the 11th, and then the response made by Israel, the respondent to the application, on January the 12th. And then 2 weeks later, on January the 26th, the International Court of Justice came forward and delivered the provisional orders that was requested by South Africa, because the formal hearings on the allegation made has to take place. That is, the trial has to take place, and the trial hasn't taken place yet, and witnesses will be called and so on and so forth. And that might take as long as a year, year and a half, before a decision, the final decision, comes down, whether Israel has committed genocide or not. So the January 26th resolution that you're talking about, Robert, is the provisional measures that South Africa asked for to be delivered so that the rights of the Palestinians as a group, a people, in terms of the Genocide Convention, should not be prejudiced, and that there was an urgency that had to be met. And therefore, South Africa asked for provisional measures. And so those provisional measures were given. The ICJ ruling of January 26 comes down with the operative clause at the end of its order, which lays down four or five orders with the justices voting 15 to 2 or 16 to 1 in getting those orders passed and agreed upon. So, number one, the ICJ repudiated the claim of Israel that the ICJ does not have the jurisdiction because of the arguments that Israel made. And Israel, in return, asked that the case be removed from the general list, that is, the application be removed from the general list. And the ICJ basically repudiated both those points and accepted that the prima facie evidence on the issue of jurisdiction stands based upon Article 9 of the Convention. And so South Africa's case was given the standing. So the ICJ will do the trial. And then in a whole list of arguments that the ICJ presented after the hearing, describing the hearing in the order, agreed with the South African position that there was a plausible case to be made that there had been violation of the Geneva Convention. So a link was drawn between the argument presented by South Africa and the convention. And so that link established the plausible case of genocide and that Israel has to abide by the order that was given.
Right. So first of all, this is not historic in a sense that the ICJ has rendered similar decisions in the past. For example, I think it was the Gambia versus Myanmar and also with the Serbian situation. So that history is not unique. But what I'd like to know is, where did we go from here? A year and a half, maybe, between this provisional decision and a final ruling regarding whether or not Israel is committing genocide under the terms of the convention. And a lot of water can go under the bridge in that time. The war could be over in that time. As a matter of fact, Bibi Netanyahu was just out the other day saying that they expect it to be finished in a few months, not years. So where do we go from here? They've told Israel, abide by the convention. The allegations are plausible, meaning likely that you're committing genocide, but we can't prove it just yet. So what is Israel to do?
Well, right off the bat, Israel is now under, so to speak, the magnifying glass of the convention. The title of the convention that was presented in December of 1948 and passed and adopted in January 1951, and Israel was one of the first countries to sign in, you know, and become a party to that convention. So the whole title of the convention is Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. Mm-hmm. The entire treaty or convention is basically four pages, what it should be, you know, that then it will be left to the court to see to it how the allegations brought against a party, in this case, the allegation, that is the application brought by South Africa under the convention, is applied to the party that is being accused of violating the convention, in this case, Israel. So Israel is under scrutiny now because by the provisional order, the ICJ has accepted that application that has been submitted, right? So your question, what happens then? So this might carry on. I mean, the trial, the judges recognize and have made it clear that this is provisional. The trial might take a year, year and a half before they come down. It has been given four or five orders precisely to take into account immediately much of the dispute or interpretation or views that has been in the public domain, in the media, by the journalists, is that the ICJ did not order a ceasefire. Well, the ICJ does not have that power to order a ceasefire. That will have to come from the Security Council. It is a finding that ICJ has come up with, and the order that ICJ has given will go to the Security Council. Or if it fails in the Security Council, it might go to the General Assembly. The ICJ is the world court of the United Nations. And parties that are involved in the ICJ hearings are the member states. So the ICJ has now made the ruling. Its enforcement mechanism goes into the hands of the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly. Now, if Israel continues to violate the orders that has been given, that is, obstruct, does not hold back the fire, and so on and so forth, does not provide for medicine, hospitals, water, electricity, the whole list of things which the Israeli government has been using to punish the people in Gaza, apart from the systematic bombing that has gone on from October, at least the 8th, till as we are speaking, and Gaza has been reduced to a moonscape. All of that will be then evidence in the trial. And the UN is now responsible for what the UN is going to do to implement or enforce the ICJ orders. My further point on this matter is that there is no statutory limitation on the ruling. So let's assume that 2 years from now, Gaza is a parking lot, and the 2 million people of Gaza has been removed from Gaza, either killed, hospitalized, wounded, or refugees scattered somewhere in the Sinai or among other Arab states and so on and so forth. And 2 years from now, the final decision comes down that Israel has committed a genocide. Israel will be then liable for restitution, reparation, and all of that that is involved in terms of the definition or description of what is a punishment. That will be determined by the court then, because that is part of the punishment. Part of the responsibility of the Israeli state is to punish those who have committed the genocide, if that's the decision, right? So the Israeli courts, the Israeli state will be responsible to see to it that those who have carried all orders of the state that the ICJ has judged to be genocide be brought to the court, whether it is the Israeli court or the International Criminal Court, as you mentioned, Yugoslavia. The leaders of Yugoslavia were brought to the International Criminal Court and judgment were passed, held as prisoners. Slobodan Milosevic died in prison. There are others who are still in prison. So all of those things are up, you know, in the sense of the unfolding drama that now follows. I might say one more thing finally on this particular issue. The provisional order indicates that 15-2 and 16-1, that is the overwhelming majority of the judges, are leaning in the direction that there is a plausible case of genocide.
What the Palestinians are going through right now is by definition of a genocide. You can get upset with that if you want, but a lot of people are like, oh, you're changing the definition of genocide. No, you didn't know what the definition of genocide was. You have to look it up. It turns out there's been a lot of genocides that you didn't think about because that's the definition of genocide. Here's the positive part. The Palestinian people are strong. The Palestinian people are very, very strong. They're the only ones who could be surviving this madness. We have good, innocent civilians fighting for their lives against the deprivation of basic human rights. Like, we're gonna cut off their food, we're gonna cut off their water. It's like, have you heard of Ramadan? They've been training for this their whole lives. You're messing with the wrong folks. This just brings them closer to God. But my friend was like, why don't you make jokes about the Israeli military? Are you scared? I'm like, no, I'm an American, I pay taxes, I can make fun of anybody I support, right? So yeah, I don't do that, because when the people beg me to stop bombing, I stop. All right. Just want to make sure. I'm not bombing right now, right? I just want to make sure I'm not bombing or my jokes didn't go up into the air and misfire. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page here.
When I think of the word genocide, prior to this conversation and me researching it in advance of this discussion, what pops into my mind, and then I would assume most of the general public's mind, is the Holocaust. And I look up the dictionary definition of genocide, and it's the definition I think that most people think it is, and that is, quote, the systematic and widespread extermination or attempted extermination of a national, racial, religious, or ethnic group. So exterminate means to wipe out completely every man, woman, and child. Systematic means systematic. There is a process in place, just like the Nazis did, rounding people up, putting the Star of David on it, identifying them, shipping them off in cattle cars, gassing them, stripping them, burning the evidence. But this is not what the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide means. I'm just going to read what they list as their characteristics of genocide, just so people say that, come on, Israel's not doing that to the Gazans, you know? But that's not the definition. Let's read it here. It was first coined, the word genocide was first coined by Raphael Lemkin in 1944, after he fled Axis-occupied Europe, and he lost 49 members of his family to the Holocaust. The term in the convention covers a much broader set of actions besides simply killing members of a group, and here they are. Besides killing, you have causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. It's pretty broad. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. So you don't have to kill everybody, just in part. What's part? One person? Undefined. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forced sterilization, for example. And finally, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Okay, so kicking them out of the area. So these are pretty broad. Now, given this very exhaustive and broad set of conditions, wouldn't it be fair to say, Salim, that any nation fighting any war anywhere could be accused of genocide? Or to put it into this context, how's Israel supposed to defend itself against an enemy who hides behind civilians, given this definition of genocide?
First of all, the definitional side of the issue that you have raised, the convention, which both of us have on the table, I have it right in my hand, as I said, it's only 4 pages. The member states of the UN have signed on to it. And by signing on to it, then they're obliged to abide by what they have signed on to, right?
True.
In the judgment that came down on the issue, which was the first issue that the court dealt with, that is the prima facie jurisdiction, which was the bulk of the argument of the Israeli legal team. And I'm reading from the order. In paragraph 18, on the prima facie jurisdiction, the International Court of Justice noted, neither of the parties has entered a reservation to Article 9 or any other provision of the convention. So before they go into the court, that is, when they signed on to the convention, in the case of Israel, Israel signed on to the convention in 1951, 3 years after the convention was drafted. And I believe South Africa signed on to the convention in 1998, or within the first few years of becoming a post-apartheid state, right? It became a post-apartheid state with the election of Nelson Mandela as president in 1994. So we are now talking about the definition, not from a dictionary, but the way the convention lays out what is a genocide. And in Article 2, from which you read, Article 2A, killing members of the group, it doesn't say killing all members of the group. You know, it could be killing 5 members of a 50,000 or 1 member of the 50,000 member. That is, in other words, a targeted group that has been defined. And then all the other points that you have read. So those are the points in a generic sense has been put down as committing genocide, and it would be for the court to decide. So it is not arbitrary. Both the side knows what is permissible and what is not permissible.
You're right. They both signed on to it. Yes.
Yeah. And on the question of the point that you made, that in any war, there is a genocide or a possibility of a genocide, and then you define it as one of the parties are hiding behind civilian population and so on. As warfare has become technologically industrial and so on and so forth, the civilian population are targets. Again, if there is no statutory limitation on genocide, Britain is a member of the Genocide Convention, and Britain is not only the member of the Genocide Convention. After they signed on to the Genocide Convention, Britain then brought the law of Britain, that is the domestic law of Britain, its own statute of Britain, to adopt the Genocide Convention. So within the statutes of Britain, the case can be brought against any member of the government that is found to be, again, within Article 3, complicit in a genocide. So there's the case, not from too long ago, of an Israeli foreign minister who was going to Britain to attend a conference in Britain at the invitation of the British government. Did not go in 2009. In 2006, there was a Gaza war, and the minister was involved in it as part of the government. The minister I'm talking about is Zippy Lipni, who was a foreign minister at that time of the Israeli government. Again, Netanyahu was the prime minister, and she was involved in the action that was taking on. And NGOs in Britain and private people in Britain took the matter in their hand and applied to the Attorney General to charge Zippy Lipni, when she is in Britain, with war crimes, not under the convention, but under war crimes. And so Zippy Lipni did not go because she could have been arrested. The issue at hand is governments are signatories, and so therefore governments are responsible, you know, and charges can be made. People can be arrested, brought to court, and then can be dismissed also. It is not the fact that you allege somebody. What does prima facie stand for? That there is an appearance of a crime. So there's enough of an evidence appearing a crime has been committed so that an indictment can take place. And when an indictment takes place, the indicted person or country then will provide its argument why it is a false case. And the court will decide, you know.
You've made a very good point in that, even though I personally find the characterization of genocide under the convention to be very broad and all-consuming, to the point where I'd say that you can't have a war anymore without being declared a genocidal maniac. Even though that may be the case, Israel signed on to it. Israel knew in 1948, right, when it became a nation, and when it signed on to it, that this was the definition of genocide. It knew. So if it is doing things which can go against that convention, then I can understand why a country like South Africa or any other country might say that, hold on a moment, Israel, you're violating the convention. It may not be what the person on the streets thinks is genocide, a la Holocaust, but it's against the convention which you signed on to. So you make a fair point.
In this judgment that we are talking about, ICJ provisional orders of January 26, the ICJ reminds both parties that in 1946, this ruling came out of the UN General Assembly, which went into the convention of 1948. And this is what the General Assembly resolution says. Genocide is a denial of the right of existence of entire human groups, as homicide is the denial of the right to live of individual human beings. So if you want the definitional point of view in a very compact way, there's the definition that was given. That definition is not in the convention itself.
This is a question I have to ask you. You may have to speculate on it, but this convention has been in existence since 1948, and it's only been used a couple of times, right? I've already mentioned Gambia versus Myanmar and Yugoslavia, and now Israel. But there have been innumerable wars and conflicts between nations since 1948. Yet, In current two decades, all we see is when Israel does something, which, by the way, the death count in Gaza is nothing compared to some of the death counts in these conflicts. For example, the Vietnam War. When Israel does something, bam, you've got somebody claiming genocide against them. All the other nations, or almost all of them, can seem to get away with their conflicts without being labeled as genocide. Why?
Well, there's no one silver bullet answer. The why can be a whole panoply of politics involved in it, right? So let me take two instances as two problematic cases that we have. But before I go to the two instances, let me answer the question of numbers that have been victims of wars or killings, as in the situation in Gaza, have far exceeded the numbers of what has happened in Gaza. That's the point you made, if I understood you correctly.
Yes.
Well, let's put that in some context before I move on. At the time or the moment when this ruling came down on January 26th, the conflict began on October 7th. And so you had January 26th, that's a little over 3 months, right? In that 3 months, the numbers cited based upon UN agency report. So we are going back to the United Nations. The number cited was, I'm reading from my memory now, was something in the range of 25,700 killed and something like 63,000 wounded. And practically all of the people in Gaza Strip, which constitutes a population of something close to 2 million or a little over 2 million, affected by the bombing and the fighting that have taken place. So just let me stick to the killed figure. 25,700 was the number cited. Half of that number were women and children. Now, in 2 million, 25,700 constitutes a little over 1% of the population. 1% of the population in Gaza. What would be 1% of the population, say, in Canada? Over 500,000. What would be 1% of the population in the United States? Over 3.5 million.
Well, sure. In relative versus absolute numbers, you may have a case about the magnitude.
But I'm talking about the magnitude. It's because the number in itself doesn't say anything. Because you see, as we go to Article 2, and it talks about in whole or in part, it doesn't put a number there.
Oh, this is true. My question is not about necessarily the numbers. My question is about why Israel versus, say, East Pakistan or Vietnam, United States and Vietnam.
So now coming back to why Israel and why not others, and the short answer was it is the member states that have to bring the allegation or the application. And that's where the whole issue of politics comes in. So I said, let's take the case of two examples. In the case of United States and Vietnam, and the case that has been applied, that is the case of Ukraine against Russia. And again, we have already pointed out that there's no statutory limits over here. The Vietnam War is over, and it was not simply the casualty figures of Vietnam, 3 million. It was the manner in which the war was conducted. Chemical weapons were used. Agent Orange was used. Destruction of towns, cities, and people, civilian population. All of that would amount to a case, or should have been made in the 1960s when this was going on, because the convention was there on the table. But no country applied to the United Nations and charged that America is engaged in a genocide. America is not going to self-indict itself, but no other country did that. And the why is pretty much clearly understood. America was the superpower. The war in Vietnam, in America's definition, was fought to contain the expansion of communism. The world was divided into East and West Bloc, Soviet Union and United States, that if Vietnam was not contained, there would be a domino effect, etc. And United States, not only being a superpower, United States was also a permanent member of the Security Council with veto power. And it's not only that no indictment or application was brought alleging America is engaged in a genocide, there was no measures taken in the Security Council? And the answer is very simple. It would have been vetoed. In the case of Russia, the special military operation that began in February of 2022, no measures were brought into the Security Council, or if it was brought in, Russia vetoed it because Russia is a permanent member.
Salim, if I could interject for a moment, I think it's pretty much understood that if this ever got, this particular ICJ decision ever came down against Israel and went to the Security Council for enforcement, the United States would veto it.
Right. The matter goes into the Security Council, United States vetoes it, and then the General Assembly steps in and says this matter cannot be resolved in the Security Council because the history of the Security Council on the issue of Israel is the use of veto by the United States shielding Israel as the country that has violated not only a whole list of Security Council rulings, a whole list of General Assembly rulings, but has now violated the Genocide Convention. And a state that engages in genocide cannot be the member of the United Nations. And so they invoke the UN Resolution 377 and then act upon it, whatever the act that the General Assembly decides to act. It can be that the General Assembly expels Israel from the UN. It could be that with the expulsion, the UN demands that Israel come up with a reparation and the restitution, just as in the case of Holocaust, the reparation demanded from Germany. So all of those things can be demanded.
I don't really have any material about Israel-Palestine. I do think with everything going on and with Israel and Palestine, it is the first time my black friends have ever been nervous to talk to me about something. They're like, hey, shalom.
And that's why I don't think people like, you're worried there's going to be an attack in America? I don't think so, because we got capitalism here. That has a diluting effect on hatred. It really does, you know? You can be angry until you get here, but then once you eat some Arby's, shop at Costco, go to a strip club, you're like, I'm mad, but I'm not that mad, all right? You know, I'm not like, kill the infidels mad. I'm like, I'm gonna blog about this mad, you know? I have some angry comments to leave. Oh, God, this is fun for me. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to me, everyone's like, you gotta stop bombing Palestinians, you know, because we care so much about Palestinian lives, but no one's even suggested maybe Hamas should surrender. Isn't that weird? That's not even on the menu, which just goes to show, it really pays off to just be the crazy dude in a fight. If you are, they're just so insane that the whole world is like, well, we can't talk to those guys, okay? So you're gonna have to take responsibility for this. I'm just saying, if you're unsure about how to handle a negotiation, try being a death cult. It can help. People are like, I'm a little bit worried about this. And I've been studying the history of the conflict, Israel and Gaza. And it turns out, remember, ladies, when you were all making fun of your dudes for studying the Roman Empire? They were kind of onto something. They were ahead of the curve. Well, that's a little history joke, I guess. Stop mocking boyfriends who know history, because it repeats itself. Yeah. I know this feels awkward right now, but I'm not stopping.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online.
This seems to be a no-win scenario because the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, has in their convention, their charter essentially, and there's two of them, but the first one hasn't been rescinded, basically that all of Israel is Palestine and that there should be no Jews, zero, genocide, Jews in Palestine from the river to the sea. Likewise, I mean, the religious right in Israel is also claiming from the river to the sea, but that's another matter. You have Saudi Arabia just recently saying that Palestine must be recognized as a full member of the United Nations. And you have also these competing forces. Israel, just recently, Bibi Netanyahu came out and said that while the conflict should be over in the next few months, right now they're in Khan Yunis, I think, and that's far south in Gaza, they intend to bring to justice every single member of Hamas and then occupy Gaza because it has demonstrated itself not to be able to keep the peace. So they gave them a chance withdrawing for many years, 18 years or so, not a single Jew in Gaza, not a single Israeli troop member in Gaza. Yes, they surrounded the three borders that they control, but not the southern Egyptian border. And yet Gaza has demonstrated that they're unable, at least with Hamas in control, to keep the peace, especially since it's right in the charter of Hamas that they are genocidal. They want to destroy the state of Israel, completely wipe it off the map, and every Jew that lives from the river to the sea. So this is hypothetical, Salim, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I don't see an end to it. This has been going on since Moses, more or less, not to make a pun out of it, but this has no end in sight, the way I see it. Can you see an end to this conflict?
Well, the way you framed the question, there is no end.
Yeah.
That's not what we began with, and we are talking about back to the ICJ ruling, back to the United Nations. United Nations set the rules. When a member state signs on to the United Nations, when a member state or an individual signs on to an agreement, that means you're going to live according to that agreement. That's the contract. And when you break that contract, then there will be the remedy that will be brought to enforce that contract.
You've answered my question then. You're putting your hope and your faith in the United Nations, which is a fair answer. However, then what has to happen is the United States has to understand that the only way out of this is for them to reconsider their support of Israel.
Well, yes and no. Look, United States is not a monolithic country. It's a huge country, 340 million people and growing. It has its own history. It has its own constitution. It has its own ways of looking at the world, its national interests. And I take an example apart from Israel. Israel is the post-1945 example. The example of Taiwan, that was China, nationalist China, during the Second World War and before the Second World War. And nationalist China was an ally of the United States. And when the war ended, the Second World War ended, the war against Japan ended in 1945 after the bombing in Hiroshima and Nagasaki by Truman. There was a nationalist China. There was a government of nationalist China, Chiang Kai-shek. But internally, within China, there was a revolution going on. And eventually, the revolution forces of the Communist Party defeated the forces of the nationalist government, which was an ally of the United States, and took over the mainland China, and the nationalist government fled to Taiwan. That happened in 1949. From 1949 to 1972, this rump state of Taiwan, nationalist China, Kuomintang, claimed to represent all of China. Half a billion people at that time, you know, somewhere around about 400, 500 million people. Whereas the government and the state that represented that 400, 500 million people, the People's Republic of China, was excluded from the United Nations, right? And the reason it was excluded from the United Nations, because the United States protected its ally, that is the Nationalist Chinese, in Taiwan. And Nationalist Chinese occupied the seat in the Security Council. And the People's Republic of China was not recognized. After almost quarter century, while many other allies of the United States had recognized People's Republic of China, France, Britain, of course, the emerging countries of the global south, like India and so on, so were all in recognition of People's Republic of China. China didn't have a seat in the United Nations. But then, eventually, the government of the United States at that time, headed by a Republican president, President Nixon, traveled to People's Republic of China. And in the aftermath of his travels and recognition of People's Republic of China, which was then accepted by the Senate in the United States, according to its constitutional law, China was recognized, diplomatic representation was exchanged, and America withdrew its veto on Republic of China being seated in the United Nations. And on all of that happened, and Taiwan, claiming to be the nationalist China, was removed from the United Nations. They don't have a seat in the United Nations, right? It happens. That's politics. So that's the question I was going to say. You know, yes, there is a view at the present time in the United States that seems to be almost monolithic. But I would also argue that monolithic view about United States and Israel, the special relationship or the protection and so on, that began in 1945 after the end of the Second World War, precisely during the debate leading up to the establishment of Israel by the United Nations and the vote that Truman gave in support of that establishment against the advice of his own government. The senior most members of his government, the Secretary of State, General George Marshall, the Assistant Secretary of State, Loy Henderson, the Secretary of Defense, James Forrestal, just to name a few people, they were all against the recognition of Israel in 1948. They were all against it. They advised against it. In fact, General Marshall went so far as to say that if President Truman, and these are all on public record, if President Truman is going to go ahead and recognize his Jewish state, then I will be in a position where I have to decide whether I support my president or I vote against my president in the coming election, the coming election being 1948. The matter was so serious. So there is a very strong view inside the United States, or substantially strong, that Israel is not a strategic ally of the United States, no more than Ukraine is a strategic ally of the United States. The United States has much bigger national interests than simply, you know, being tied up with Ukraine or with Israel, or as it was with nationalist China in the period that has now become historical and people don't remember. But the United Nations is not dealing with what the ultra-right-wing Bibi Netanyahu and his government and his people, or those who are of that political view, religious view, that the right of Israel comes from the Bible. That argument was repudiated by the Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, when he said the Bible is not the land registry for the Middle East. So what is the registry for the Middle East? The United Nations. So the problem is, and the problem has been, the violation of the United Nations ruling, the only legitimacy, the only instrument by which the state of Israel exists today, is not by what was said to Abraham in the covenant, that the land of Canaan belongs to your seed. Well, if the land of Canaan belongs to the seeds of Abraham, then Abraham had two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. And so the land belongs to the seeds of Ishmael, who are Arabs, and the seeds of Isaac, who are Jews and Israelites, right? So even on the argument of the ultra-right, that argument doesn't stand. Neither it stands on the side of Hamas, nor does it stand on the side of the right-wing Israelis from the river to the sea, right? Because there's Ishmael and there's Isaac. My point is, we're talking about international law. We're talking about United Nations. And the contest on the meanings of the resolutions and the arguments of the resolution is something that can only be resolved by the United Nations agency. And the highest agency is the International Court of Justice. It's not you, it's not me, it's not President Biden, it's not Putin, it's not Xi Jinping. It is the highest court, which is the World Court. They're ruling, you know, and then it will be up to the member states adopting those ruling or defying those rulings. If you adopt that ruling, you are legitimate. If you defy that ruling, you are illegitimate. You can keep defying it. Taiwan is defying it. It was kicked out. You can keep defying it, but there's going to be cost for that defiance. The ultimate cost can be you are at war with the member states of the United Nations, as happened in Korea or as happened in Yugoslavia. So Israel is walking on a very thin ice after this decision. And if this decision materializes in a final decision, the ice will become even thinner, that it can crack and Israel will go down between the river and the sea. In other words, it is in a very precarious position, and its moral rectitude has been cracked, if not shattered.
Good evening. Are you expecting applause? Have you come to take a bow? I just wanted to say thank you. For what? Allowing you to manipulate me so completely. For being a decent human being. That's why we selected you in the first place, Doctor. We needed somebody who wanted to play the game, but who'd only go so far. When the time came, you stood your ground. You did the right thing. You reached out to an enemy, you told her the truth, you tried to stop a murder. Federation needs men like you, Doctor. Men of conscience, men of principle. Men who can sleep at night. You're also the reason Section 31 exists. Someone has to protect men like you from a universe that doesn't share your sense of right and wrong.
Should I feel sorry for you? Should I be weeping over the burden you are forced to carry in order to protect the rest of us?
It is an honor to know you, Doctor. Good night.
Share to security.
Odo here.
Never mind. My mistake.
Tough conversations with my more conservative parents. When you talk about Israel-Palestine, it makes you miss those kind of like easier to swallow debates, like trans women playing sports.
So, as I foresee, this matter will go into the Security Council. There will be debates, and Security Council will be given enough opportunity to come up with a ruling. All the other rulings of the Security Council stands. None of these rulings have been abrogated. And these rulings have been violated by Israel because of the shield that the United States has provided through veto. But that can be exhausted. And I believe, and I think, it is very close to being exhausted, because this ruling that there has been or there can be a plausible case of genocide. Once this ruling gets consolidated, I don't know, I don't have a crystal ball. That will depend upon the trial and the evidence. But in the provisional order, it has been pointed out by the International Court of Justice, there are two things needed. One is the intent to commit genocide, and one is the actions that sums up to being a genocide. In both instances, the court has given a provisional plausible evidence by citing the highest members of the Israeli government, including the president of Israel, speaking in a language which goes to demonstrate that there is an intent to commit genocide, and there has been no retraction.
About that, Salim, if I could, I take issue with their using those quotes by the defense minister and Israel Katz, minister of energy and infrastructure. For example, when Gallant says, he's the minister of defense, says we are fighting human animals and we will act accordingly. Yes, you can take that to mean all Gazans, every man, woman, and child. But then again, when Donald Trump says that we're letting in murderers and rapists from Mexico, the left pounced on him saying that Donald Trump said all Mexicans are murderers and rapists. Well, that's not true. And so when Israel Katz says, and I'll quote here, quote on Twitter, we will fight the terrorist organization Hamas. And by the way, this is a quote that was in the ICJ's decision. So this is the quote they're using. We will fight the terrorist organization Hamas and destroy it. All the civilian population in Gaza is ordered to leave immediately. So they make the distinction between the people of Gaza and the people they're fighting. So I don't know if those quotes can be used effectively to say that there's intent.
Well, what we say and what we write becomes evidence. Whether it can be used or not, it's to, again, the eye of the beholder. We are talking about the justices, the judges. True. What Donald Trump says and what he said, if it had been taken to the courts as prima facie evidence that Donald Trump is a bigot, we don't know what the ruling would be. But he said it, right? In the political arena, we are not in a court of law. We are in a court of public opinion. So in the political arena, in the court of public opinion, Donald Trump's words were nullified by the majority of the people who voted for Donald Trump. Correct? Because that is the court of public opinion. For the man to be the president and said, you know, this is not what he meant as you described it. All Mexicans are rapists. And so that, or whatever was their calculation, they did not take Donald Trump's word in a legal sense to malign him and condemn him as a bigot. But if Donald Trump had been taken to a court of law, we don't know. America, of course, has First Amendment rights. And so, you know, that would have been a case. But in the case that we are talking about, and the justices in paragraph 5, the justices took note. This is a serious matter. These are justices taking note. The matter is going to go to the UN Security Council. It'll go to the General Assembly. And they took the notes of the words that were stated by the War Cabinet. But not only that, this is only the preliminary. As I said right at the outset, that with this provisional order, Israel is under the magnifying glass now. Right, every action will be taken into account in the trial proceedings of what Israel has said, what Israel has done, how Israel has conducted itself before this ruling was given, and how it has conducted itself after the ruling was given. After the ruling was given is that there is now a red light on. It's not an amber light. There was never a green light. Red light is on and you're driving through the red light. Because exactly that's what Bibi Netanyahu said, the prime minister said. It doesn't matter what the International Court of Justice says. We're going to do what we have to do.
There is a legal maxim, a Latin phrase, which basically says what Benjamin Netanyahu is, and that is that inter arma enim silent legis, which means for among arms, the laws are silent. To Benjamin Netanyahu, he's in an existential war, a constant threat from the Islamic Resistance Movement and the Muslim Brotherhood. And so he says, to hell with the United Nations, to hell with the convention, we're going to defend our people. So does he have a case? That's again up to the Court of Justice, isn't it?
It is, but you and I, since we are talking about this, since you're raising this issue, we have our views on this matter. Whatever decision the court comes down with, I mean, the Roe versus Wade decision that came down in 1975, that abortion is a right, which was not listed in the Bill of Rights in the American Constitution, you know. The court came down and for 50 years, that right was duly practiced in American system till now the decision was given that no, I mean, it will go to the states. But in the interim period for 50 years, people debated this issue among themselves. Mm-hmm. Right? So we are debating this. So that's the view of not only people outside of Israel, the people inside of Israel have to debate, because it is not only a decision that has come down, provisional decision, anticipating a final decision at some point in time, has come down, which makes every Israeli citizen responsible in terms of their government. Are they willing to go along with the government that is genocidal or not? My argument would be that it is Bibi Netanyahu and the Likud right wing and Israelis with that mindset who are using this argument both of Holocaust and of existential problem as a shield to carry on their agenda and to basically silence their critic, not only within Israel, but outside Israel. You know, this whole issue of anti-Semitism, which is hate speech and so on and so forth. The American Congress came down recently with a resolution that any reference to speech that can be construed as anti-Semitism is going to be illegal and punishable, you know? So the argument from the other side, or the argument that I'm making, is this is a phony argument. It is their own imaginary argument, because there is no existential threat that is being made that will lead to a destruction of Israel, except what Israel itself is doing by not abiding by the UN resolution. If Israel is abiding and had abided by the UN resolution, any country trying to engage, or any people trying to engage, in this case Hamas, threatening Israel's existence, would be met, would be counted within the framework of the UN resolutions, within the framework of the UN Charter, within the framework of what eventually now has come down to the ICJ ruling, you know. And Israel has its friends. Its biggest friend that has shielded Israel right through all of this problem that has culminated to where we are. If Israel had not been shielded by the United States for the last 57 years, that is going back to 67 war, we would not be discussing this today.
That is a fascinating point, in that here is Israel pinning all of its hopes of its existence continuing from this point forward on the political moods of another nation, the United States, which can change on a dime or change on an election. That is no way to go into the future as a state. I think that you're right that they have to think of a long-term solution without the United States as an ally in this matter, if they want to continue to exist. So, fascinating. Thank you, Salim. I always appreciate your input. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Robert.
Reflecting on today's discussion, I'm left with an uncomfortable dilemma regarding the nature of what constitutes valid contract law. Is a contract valid and enforceable if its language has been distorted to a point where the words and terms redefined no longer have any bearing or reference to their original meanings? Suppose that both sides in a contract have agreed to redefine the word murder to mean causing embarrassment or discomfort, or to say that the expression of words is the same as resorting to physical violence, or to say that experimental, never-tested injections are safe vaccines, or to say that males are females. Well, to paraphrase Salim, it happens. That's politics. And politics itself is a subject that always demands our greater understanding, a goal that we shall continue to pursue when you join us again next week as we continue our journey in the right direction. And until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right, and be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
I have an Israeli barber. He does my beard. And while he was cutting my beard, he was asking me about my thoughts on Israel and Palestine. And I noticed that the closer the blade got to my throat, the more I became pro-Israeli.